author of Why You Should Be a Socialist. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the New Republic, The Nation, and elsewhere. And he's written about the implications of artificial intelligence software. He's also leading a workshop on the technology. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, on K282BH Flamath on 104.3 FM, K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and streaming on web at kboo.fm.
You probably know that KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored, but did you know that 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you? You can always make a donation to keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. But right now, during our end-of-the-year drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Help us reach our goal of $70,000 by December 31st. Make your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today. And thanks.
Radio is the sound salvation.
Welcome to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. You are listening to Civic Cypher.
Be sure to stick around. We got a whole lot in store for you today. Kind of a heavy show, but something that is quite educational. We're going to be dealing a lot of with what was, and then we're going to do our best to bring it to what is. And so we'll take some time and we'll talk about slavery and the implications of slavery. I want to start off by making sure that we discuss how slavery in the United States was different than slavery around the world. This is something that comes up a lot in conversations, especially, you know, these days. And, you know, you may not know how to address that, how to approach that. You know, a lot of people use, you know, slavery as being so long ago, or they use slavery as being something of a global human phenomenon to distance themselves from the actual implications of slavery. And we reject that general attitude. You know, around here we like to fall on the sword if we need to, and so we're going to give you everything that you need to know exactly how to deal with those conversations and, you know, maybe your own prejudices in your own mind, because let's be honest, you know, we still have those despite our best efforts and our best intentions. So we're going to take some time to talk about slavery in America. We're also going to take some time to talk about the Willie Lynch letter, which is something that we have mentioned on the show. It comes up a lot in hip hop songs and so forth. So we're going to actually delve into that a bit. And for our Way Black History Fact, we're going to discuss more slavery. So a heavy show, but again, one that will be educational and one that we believe will certainly make a difference. But first and foremost, we will start off with Ebony Excellence, shall we?
Shall we?
We shall. So This week, Ebony Excellence is sponsored by BINnews.com and the Black Information Network Daily Podcast. Be sure to check out both of those, hosted by yours truly. We're going to shout out a special young lady. She goes by the name of A. Piper McCoy, who is the VP of Communications for BuzzFeed. And we actually had a chance to see her work and to see the results of her work. And, you know, one of the things that we do every year is we visit ComplexCon. And obviously we have a very strong media relationship with, you know, these companies. And we actually got to see some Black girl magic in real life. And it was very inspirational. And just knowing where she stands in the world, and I'll read a bit more. You can certainly appreciate why we're shouting her out. So again, VP of Communications for BuzzFeed, works with the PR team and has a slate of responsibilities overseeing all internal and external communications for Complex Networks, slate of brands, First We Feast, Pigeons and Plain, Soul Collector, and more. Responsible for the licensing, brand partnerships, and experiential, including ComplexCon, ComplexLand, and Eat Your Feed Festival. Comms all across the BuzzFeed Inc., which includes BuzzFeed, Complex Networks, Huffington Post, and Tasty. And you can find her on IG at Frost Tarte. That is FROSTTARTE. Just an amazing person, someone who beams excellence. And if we can shout her out, we got two microphones, we're gonna do it right.
Yeah, magic is the key word in the Black Girl Magic with Piper. And yes, shout out to our boy Brett over at Complex as well.
All right, so slavery in America. This comes from so you may know this, I've mentioned this on the show before, but I don't talk about it quite a bit. I'm subscribed to quite a few white supremacist blogs on the internet. And that's because I have to be. I need to know what it is people are thinking, what it is people are saying, what it is people are hiding behind, that is creating a distance between the us's and the them's in these very important conversations. Well, one thing that I came across that was a little troubling recently was that, you know, there's a group of people that really feel like Black people are responsible for slavery. Something that Q and I have discussed quite a bit on our various media rounds is that we take issue with the narrative that slavery was a choice made by Black people. And, you know, for those familiar with, you know, our conversations beyond just this show, you may know that that's something that, especially for Q, is it's a touchy subject, because he and, you know, me and most of us wholeheartedly disagree with that statement. It's just a complete falsehood, and it is extremely insensitive and unfair and unkind. However, there are groups of people, mostly white folks, in little pockets of the internet who are very, very racist, you know, who they need this to be true. And so they will do their best to try to build an argument that removes white people from the responsibilities of slavery and kind of put Black people in the hot seat, if you will. So this idea that Black people are responsible for slavery does exist. And if you start to feel that way, you and you're a white person, particularly an older white male, if you feel that Black people are responsible for slavery, then you feel less connected with the results of slavery. You feel less connected with sort of the responsibility to address, you know, the issues, the systemic issues and so forth. It's very easy for you to hide behind a narrative that tells you that, you know, white people are the great conquerors of the world and deserve to be so, and Black people are just born bad and they are all bad, and the reason they're bad now is because bad is the natural state of Black people. And it turns a blind eye to the reality of the situation. Like, you know, where's the most black people? In Africa. If you go to Africa, you find that there are black people that are literally kings and queens, and they're full complex societies all the way down to, you know, some bad people, you know, and there's not nearly as many people in prison in Africa, but we have a whole separate, you know, prison problem in this country. And to those people who say, you know, Africa is, you know, very poor, that Africa is, you know, on and on. A lot that has to do with that is not any, it doesn't have anything to do with anything other than guns. Who has the gunpowder? Who shows up when everyone has the spears with the guns? And then, you know, the snowball effect of that, you know, who owns these lands? Who can extract the resources? You know, where is the infrastructure pointed? Is the infrastructure pointed toward the coastline so that the resources can be extracted and shipped up to Great Britain or to the Americas? Or is the infrastructure, you know, in these countries, has it developed along with the rest of the industrialized world? So, again, these falsehoods allow these often very conservative white men to insulate themselves from the reality of the situation, which is that, no, we're not really conquerors. We're more often regarded as, you know, thieves and plunderers and looters and liars and so forth, right? Now, this show has never been the sort of show that tries to lay the blame of, you know, these historical things at the feet of any person who's walking a path, doing their best to be kind and to be a brother and a sister to black people and other people in this planet. But we also have to recognize that some of us are in a better position to address these issues that continue to plague these poor communities, black communities, than others. And oftentimes it's the people with the wealth. Oftentimes those people tend to be white. So now we can talk about slavery in America. My bad, that was a mouthful, but I needed to get that all out there to kind of frame the conversation today. So let's start. Slaves were purchased from Africans. All right. That is true. That is something that, you know, we have to acknowledge on all sides. And that's okay. I don't think that's the worst thing in the world, because when you have a full picture of exactly what that means, you understand it. Bear in mind that when you hear that you can go and buy slaves, and then you go and buy slaves, you in effect create an economy where slaves is your main export. Right. And that was true for hundreds of years in Africa. Okay. But I think I'm jumping the gun here. I want to reframe slavery in your mind. Okay. And I want you to take this conversation, if you have conversations with other people, you know, in your household, holidays, birthdays, whatever, who maybe they feel distant. They feel like these problems aren't really theirs to have to deal with. This will allow you to kind of bring them into the conversation. So here's what I want you to do. Don't get mad at me, Q, because I know you tend to get mad when I do this, but I want you to change the word slave. I want you to, well, not change it. I want you to add another word to it. Let's call it child slave, okay? And everything that implies, you know, there are some very awful people in the world who may purchase a child slave for everything disgusting that you might be thinking right now, okay? And I'll refrain from using the real word that, you know, is probably in your mind, but I don't want to trigger anyone. So we'll go with child slave. Okay. So let's rethink the economy of slavery, of buying and selling human beings. Okay. And because you may have been taught, unintentionally to be racist, you know, even black people, we're taught racist stereotypes. We're not impervious to those things. Okay. So this doesn't make you a bad person. This makes you human and susceptible to propaganda, to systemic influence. Okay. But I'm going to help you cut through that, because you might think about black people a certain way, but human beings have a tendency to think of children the same way. So let's, again, instead of slavery, we'll go with child slaves. Okay. So I'm going to read this again. child slaves were purchased from Africa. Okay. Does that change a bit in your mind? Because it should. Because then it goes, then it should go, whoa, no one should be purchasing children, right? That's an awful thing to think of. What are they doing with these children? They're taking them from the home. They don't, you know, what's the point of this? But I'll continue. Bear in mind, child slaves. It might grant you a direct line of empathy, human empathy, where, you know, maybe that has been calloused over years of you thinking of Black people as criminal or Black people as whatever, right? Now let me paint another picture for you here. The slaves in Africa were often conquered tribes, okay? They were thieves or criminals that ended up in slavery. Or, you know, folks that had committed some sort of offense. You couldn't go into Africa. You couldn't be an African and then go to, you know, the country over and then buy a slave for yourself. That wasn't a thing. Slaves did not come about in that way. Slaves were, again, often the result of tribes that had been conquered, which is a thing, you know. But bear in mind that if a tribe is conquered, typically the tribe gets absorbed into the conquering tribe. And after a generation, they're all kind of one family, if you will. Okay. If you're a criminal and you break the law or you murder someone or whatever, you know, and then your punishment is slavery. If you have children, those children didn't break the law. Those children are not slaves, right? You found a lot more frequently that slaves would marry into families. You found more frequently that slavery wasn't a permanent condition. You were a slave for a time. You know, this is what would happen in Africa. So again, when there are people in these chat rooms, these racist chat rooms that say, well, Black people, or the Africans sold Black people into slavery. Well, the type of slavery in Africa was very different, a very different phenomenon from what we ended up with over here. In the U.S., it was about economics, it was about money. Slaves were not human beings in the way that they were in Africa. So it was a very different sort of a thing. For folks to say, oh, slavery existed around the world, you know, the Jews are slaves and this, that, and that, and this, all these things are very true. And we acknowledge all of those things. But if you're saying that in a way to distance yourself from the responsibility of slavery, I'm trying to help you, you know, build that bridge. So we've discussed, you know, reframing slavery around child slavery, because again, if you have the human capacity to empathize and you have been made to be calloused when it comes to Black people or affairs that affect Black people, we're going to appeal to your human condition, because Black people, as you know, are human beings, the first human beings ever. I'll move on. Slavery in the United States was based on race, meaning that it was something that followed you, the stench, the legacy followed you. Even if you found freedom, you know, the handful of slave movies you may have seen, you know, at the end, the hero gets freedom or whatever. You can be talking about Django, 12 Years a Slave, any of the slave movies. We know them all, right? Typically during that period, if the movie is from a Black person's perspective, this is what the end goal is, to be free, right? We'll talk about freedom a bit in the second half of the show, but freedom in the U.S. from slavery didn't necessarily mean freedom. Freedom from slavery in Africa absolutely could mean that, you know? And again, it's because in the United States, slavery was based around race. These group of people who look like this, they are the slaves. That is, it is a permanent condition. If they have children, then their children will be slaves and they will work for us. And this is what they do. And then they developed a whole range of reasons to justify these human rights violations you know, they preached from the parts of the Bible that that reflected to one degree or another their feelings about slavery. As you know, this country fought a civil war about slavery, which meant that approximately half of the people felt like, hey man, we're not giving up these slaves. Again, think child slaves. Okay, if you have a tough time empathizing, think child slaves. Okay, just pop that in your head. Half of the country was like, no, we need to keep these child slaves. Everything that happened to a child slave happened to black men and black women in this country. We'll get to that in a second, but you know, slavery was very popular, very lucrative, financially and otherwise. And it was based on race. This is a very different phenomenon in the borders of Africa, which again, at that time, you don't have huge prison complexes. You don't have ways to punish people that assure that they will be confined or, you know, relegated to a certain space for a certain amount of time that's as sophisticated as what we have now. You know, so slavery as a way to work off your debt to society, slavery as a way to, you know, whatever, that's your thing. You could marry, you could have children, you know, for the most part, you still were considered a human being with a degree of autonomy. Now, if you wanted to come back with certain examples, I may even allow them. I didn't find any, but, you know, certain examples of outliers, then sure. But for the most part, if we're talking about the institution of slavery, we're talking about a fundamental difference at the core of what took place in Africa versus what took place in the United States. Now, I've been talking a lot. I know you've been over there champing at the bit. Anything so far?
Sure. I mean, I'd like to really approach it from the perspective of a student.
Okay.
Right. And you playing the teacher in this example, with the topic that we're speaking of, you spoke about conquered tribes.
Mm-hmm.
I want people to think warring tribes and one lost, right? Because we talk about colonization,
mm-hmm.
and colonizers over the history of Earth have kind of fit a specific description.
Mm-hmm.
Conquered tribes in this sense is more about another thing that is not a unique phenomenon, and that's war.
Okay.
War for land or resources or whatever throughout the history of Earth has happened. And once one of the tribes or one of the countries or one of the, you know, groups wins, it was common for them to not murder or kill those who remained after the fighting was over.
Mm-hmm.
And those people became slaves or servants.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, I'm guessing, were able to work off or age out of being servants or slaves.
Yes, that's another thing.
And once, the reason why that's important is because that next generation of people, they don't have that resentment or that desire to push back because there's no longer an enemy. Like mm-hmm. you said, they've been absorbed into this tribe or into this country or into this group of people. So I kind of want to just add some more color to that point so people can understand when you say conquered tribes, you know, think war or battle or whatever you call it, one side loses, they surrender. Because after so much bloodshed or after so much death, okay, it's clear we're not gonna win here.
Mm-hmm.
We surrender, and now those people are not sentenced to death, they're sentenced to servitude, essentially. And that is much different. These people are not our slaves because they are beneath us, right? They're going to help us create more people and sustain the land that we now share.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the next generation, they're not fighting anymore, so there's no need for those people to be slaves, which is much different than you were going to be a slave here forever if one group had it their way,
mm-hmm.
because of the color of your skin. Yeah. By nature, you are beneath us. Your people are slaves. That's what they're for. That's mm-hmm. why you exist.
Crazy.
And again, a much different set of circumstances. With regards to people on the continent of Africa and their involvement with chattel slavery and the way that it led to people coming to the Americas, people making that same argument that Africans sold slaves. I'm thinking in that instance, and again, I was not around and I am not a studied historian with regards to the slave trade beyond what we learned in school, which, as you can imagine,
very little
intentionally, right? The history in some instances in a lot of countries is a propaganda of the authors who are the conquerors, who are the people who stand to be the heroes in that story. So yeah, this existed, but you know, let's paint that picture with as little color as possible. Selling off people who perhaps were conquered in those battles. And I think also not being given much in the way of choice, right? We can purchase these slaves from you, or with our guns versus your more primitive weapons, we can take them. It's your choice. I don't think this was people in Africa saying, hey, let's find as many Africans as we can to sell to the oppressor.
So watch this. So I mentioned that eventually it became that. So you're absolutely right. Initially, when the British showed up, found out that you could get some slaves, and the British, of course, they're expanding. You know, a couple of extra hands here and there might make a difference. Once they started to acquire slaves from Africa, the western coast of Africa, they ultimately created a demand to where the slave trade, the industry in Africa was built around conquering tribes for the purposes of enslaving them and selling them to white merchants. And you see at this time in Africa, this mass exodus of human beings, which coupled with, you know, lands being conquered again because of these treaties, because of a lack of gunpowder, which is a Chinese invention, I believe. You realize that Africa lost so much of what was precious, the human capital, and then of course the resources. And the crazy thing about what you mentioned is that, yeah, the history is written by the people who conquer or whatever, right? So it's funny because we know that the British were the originals to, you know, start the slave trade or whatever. Remember, America were British colonies at the time, right? But then the British loves to say that they were the first to outlaw slavery, and they conveniently leave out the fact that they paid reparations to the slaveholders. Same thing that happened in the U.S. So it's important for us to understand that this happened so that we can understand the legacy of it and the weight that it still carries in our day-to-day lives. And we're going to touch on that in the second half of the show, so stick around for that.
And now, proper propaganda. Watch it. Pull my mic back. You like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders.
If you're just tuning in to Civic Cypher, I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. You are listening to Civic Cypher.
And yeah, we got a lot for you to stick around for, including the Willie Lynch letter. For those that are unfamiliar, there is a letter that has existed for all of my adult life in the consciousness of lots of Black people. You may have heard
and
of it.
Much longer than that.
Sure, sure. And you may have heard it in hip-hop songs. You may have heard it referred to here and there, and certainly you've heard us refer to it on this show. Well, we never took the time to actually break down what it is. And of course, I can't get into the whole thing, but I'm going to share some key points with you to just kind of make that breathe a little bit. And then, of course, for our Way Black History Fact, we're going to talk about American slavery, again, compared to slavery elsewhere in the world. So a lot to stick around for. But first and foremost, let's discuss BABA, How to Become a Better Ally, Baba. This week's Baba, sponsored by Major Threads, where high fashion meets timeless menswear. Visit majorthreads.com to find out more. So, what we want you to do to become a better ally is watch a movie.
A movie?
A movie.
A movie.
Yeah, man. The movie is called Is That Black Enough For You? It's on Netflix. Is That Black Enough For You? I'll read a bit. From celebrated writer and film historian Elvis Mitchell, Is That Black Enough For You is both a documentary and deeply personal essay. The film examines the craft and power of cinema from a perspective often overlooked, the African-American contribution to films released from the landmark era of the 70s. It's a deep dive into the impact that point of view had on movies as well as popular culture. A love letter to film, it poses questions that have never been asked, let alone answered. Crucial artistic voices, including director Charles Burnett, Samuel L. Jackson, Whoopi Goldberg, Lawrence Fishburne, Zendaya, and others. Artists offer their distinctive prism on the creators and films that dazzled and inspired, providing insight into the history of Black representation going back to the earliest days of cinema and the cultural impact of witnessing unapologetic Blackness. Had a chance to watch that movie.
I still need to.
Yeah. I know I kind of surprised you with this one, but I watched that movie and I was like, you know what? We need to share it with people. It's a great film. It's not nearly as heavy as some of the other things we talk about on the show. So, you know, you're welcome to sit and enjoy it with other folks. It's not a huge tearjerk or anything like that, but it's super informative and it gives you some perspective on a facet of society that is very important. You don't even realize how important it is until you have someone like this tell you how important it is to be represented in cinema and see the impact, the cultural impact and the ripple effect. And once again, everything kind of starts off Black and then gets repackaged for the masses. So again, is that Black enough for you on Netflix? Now, the Willie Lynch letter. Let me give you some background on Willie Lynch. So there is this letter that this gentleman allegedly, I have to say that this is...
That part is important.
It's largely been suggested that the letter is not a firsthand account. It's not an original letter from an original person. This has largely been the consensus, insofar as we know, from the community, the scientific literary community that researches these things. So we have to assume this is a work of fiction. With that said, it's exceptionally profound, and we still recognize the truths written in this work of fiction. Okay.
If that be the case, we're not saying it's absolutely fiction either.
Thank you. But you know, we need to preserve our journalistic integrity here, so we're not going to gloss over that, as Q mentioned. So the Willie Lynch letter basically is Willie Lynch is supposedly an old white man who is a seasoned slaver and teaches other slavers, slaveholders, and slave masters the best way to get orderly production from their slaves without having to...
Perpetually,
yes. Without having to lynch all of them, you know, because there's a statement that I'm not sure if I put in the notes here, but I know it to be true just from being familiar with this letter. He says effectually that human beings, well, I'm sure he doesn't refer to Black people as human beings, but we have a natural tendency to seek our customary freedom. So our natural state is not to be captured and, you know, imprisoned or enslaved. Our natural state is to be free. Compares us a lot to horses. Us, by us, I mean Black people. Now, before I get into this any further, please take a moment. It might take you 30 minutes, maybe 30, 45 minutes to read through the whole thing. It will change your life. Read it once a year on Juneteenth, if nothing else. Okay, just to remind you of the legacy that slavery can have. I know. We don't like talking about slavery either. I know you don't like hearing about it. We don't like talking about it. But this letter kind of helps us bring it full circle so you understand why it's important that we talk about it, why it's important that we address it, why it's important that we talk about things like reparations, why it's important that we talk about things like systemic racism, and what it is that we need to move forward as a people so that we're not constantly on the bottom of the list for healthcare outcomes and on the bottom of the list for income inequality and on the bottom of the list for, you know, police, you know, brutality and the injustices in the criminal injustice system and so forth and so on. We don't want to be there. It's not our natural state. We don't celebrate being there. We need to fix it, but we need to have these important conversations. I'll continue. All right. So again, Willie Lynch, he writes this letter and I guess delivers a speech to other slaveholders in the South, teaching them how to get, as Q mentioned, perpetual servitude out of Black people. And I want you to listen to this letter for the brilliance of this, because it makes sense. That's why it's in the, I believe it's in the Library of Congress, even though they acknowledge it's a work of fiction, or they suggest it may be a work of fiction. That's probably the right way to say that. They still keep it on the archives as an important document that is exceptionally relative to relevant to American history. So I'll read through it, and we'll pop back and forth, me and you, Q, if that works. So he starts saying, "I have a foolproof method of controlling your Black slaves. I guarantee every one of you that if installed correctly, it will control the slaves for at least 300 years. Okay. In the actual letter, he says 300 years, if not forever. Says, on the top of my list is age, but it is only there because it starts with A. The second is color or shade. There is intelligence, size, sex, size of plantations and status on plantations, attitude of owners, whether the slaves live in the valley, on a hill, east, west, north, south, have fine hair, coarse hair, or is tall or short. Now that you have a list of differences, I shall give you an outline of action. But before that, I shall assure you that distrust is stronger than trust, and envy is stronger than adulation, respect or admiration." So this letter basically starts off with him saying that we need to separate these people. We need to create a class system that this type of hair is better than that type of hair. This type of skin is better than that. This type of status on a plantation is better than that type of status, you know, to create envy, to create division, and to separate these folks who were all slaves, but to basically, what is it, stratifying? Is that the word I'm looking for?
I'm not certain, but it's just listening to this. It's such cruel and evil genius.
That's the thing about it.
And it doesn't just apply to slaves.
It applies to human
beings. It has since then, and seems that it forever will apply to all classes of human beings.
Yeah.
The masses, the majority,
mm-hmm.
divide them.
Yeah.
And here are the ways that you can do that.
Wow.
You know, and we've read this before, so we kind of see where this is going before our listeners. Keep listening.
It's about to get deep.
Yeah, it gets heavy.
All right. So let me see. Where was I? "Don't forget, you must pitch the old Black male versus the young Black male, and the young Black male against the old Black male." Let me take a moment right here. For those of you who've watched Django Unchained, it's a Quentin Tarantino film, came out some years back. Some of this stuff is on full display. Okay. All right. Let me continue.
And that film is it satirical? But based on some truth.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's kind of the similar approach that people have to this letter, where it's, you know, these things didn't happen, but this type of stuff happened. These concepts were pulled from other places and are verified in other parts of society. They're just compiled in this. And this is kind of a Reader's Digest version of slavery, you know, or how to make a slave, which is the title of the letter. All right. "You must use the dark-skinned slaves versus the light-skinned slaves, and the light-skinned slaves versus the dark-skinned slaves." Q, that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right. "You must use the female versus the male, and the male versus the female. You must also have your white servants and overseers distrust all Blacks. It is necessary that your slaves trust and depend on us. They must love, respect, and trust only us. Gentlemen, these kits are your keys to control. Use them. Have your wives and children use them. Never miss an opportunity. If used intensely for 1 year, the slaves themselves will remain perpetually distrustful of each other." All right. "Let us make a slave. What do we need? First of all, we need a Black." I wish I could say this to you, but the FCC is listening. So we'll say a Black N-word man, a pregnant N-word woman, and her baby N-word boy. Second, we will use the same basic principles that we use in breaking a horse, combined with some more sustaining factors. What we do with horses is that we break them from one form of life to another. That is, we reduce them from their natural state in nature Whereas nature provides them with the natural capacity to take care of their offspring, we break that natural string of independence from them and thereby create a dependency status so that we may be able to get from them useful production for our business and pleasure. Now, I cut that out of the middle of a paragraph. That was a deep one. You know, I got to, again, this is the Reader's Digest of the Reader's Digest, but please read this. I'm just giving you some key points here. But as he's suggesting that we need to change the family dynamic. I'll make that point a little bit further as I continue to read, or rather he'll make the point. You'll hear me illustrate that on his behalf. And a lot of things may come together for you. When you think of like the angry black mama trope, you know, the strong black woman trope, you know, that is a function of that was born out of necessity. You'll see in just a minute. This is why that is a character in our society, where we all know this is not the woman that you want to have a problem with, versus, you know, a black man. Now, there is such thing as an angry black man, but in your mind, which one do you think you can appeal to more? Probably the black man. You don't want it with an angry black woman. I don't want it with an angry black woman. You know what I'm saying? I know what that person has gone through and what that person is trying to protect. So I'll continue. All right, here's another passage. Accordingly, both a wild horse and a wild or nature, natural, sorry, inward is dangerous, even if captured, for they will have the tendency to seek their customary freedom, as I mentioned. And in doing so, might kill you in your sleep. So what is he saying here? Be afraid of these black people, because what we're doing to them is wrong. It is not natural for them. And they may kill you in their attempts to return to their natural state, which is that of being free. So what does that do? That not only creates division within the ranks of black people in the society, but it also creates a further divide. And it kind of compromises your human capacity to empathize. You know, they'll kill you if they get the chance. Oh, well, who wants to be friends with someone who might kill them? Now let's keep them over there. You know, this is the same thing that happens when we think of the prison industrial complex. You know, you got to bear in mind that there are absolutely bad people in this world. And there are good people who end up in the criminal justice system. Mm. Because of technicalities, because they're political prisoners, because of whatever quotas that governments have to maintain in order to satisfy the privatized prison industrial complex. And so it's important that you do not feel empathy for those people who are subjected to human rights violations. This is something that's true in a lot of areas in society, not just with black and brown people, not just with prisons. But you know, stay woke. All right, I'll continue. Therefore, if you break the female mother, she will break the offspring in its early years of development. And when the offspring is old enough to work, she will deliver it up to you. For her normal female protective tendencies will have been lost in the original breaking process. For example, take the case of the wild stud horse, a female horse and an already infant horse, and compare the breaking process with two captured inward males in their natural state, a pregnant inward woman with her infant offspring. Now it's about to get heavy, okay? So buckle up. Take the stud horse, break him for limited containment. Completely break the female horse until she becomes very gentle, whereas you or anybody can ride her in comfort.
Can you explain what you or anybody can ride her in comfort means in this context?
I can absolutely do it. I think that you're asking the question answers it, but I will kind of paint a little bit more of that picture. You or anybody can ride her in comfort means that you will not get any pushback. And that she now acknowledges that this is a life and death decision, and she's choosing life, and what comes with it is this.
And we're no longer talking about the horse.
And I will make that point abundantly clear with this next paragraph. When it comes to breaking the uncivilized inward, use the same process, but vary the degree and step up the pressure so as to do a complete reversal of the mind. Go ahead.
Pause for a second.
Go ahead.
When it comes to breaking a person, step up the degree of pressure. So take what you would do to a horse and increase the amount of pressure that you apply. Am I reading that correctly?
That's literally what it says.
Proceed.
Take the meanest and most restless inward. Strip him of his clothes in front of the remaining male inwards, the female, and the inward infant. Tar and feather him. Tie each leg to a different horse faced in opposite directions. Set him afire and beat both horses to pull him apart in front of the remaining inward. The next step is to take a bull whip and whip the remaining inward male to the point of death in front of the female and the infant. Don't kill him, but put the fear of God in him, for he can be useful for future breeding. So what this does, and please read this for yourself, that was a graphic point in this letter. Again, I'll remind you that what I read to you was actually what this says and actually what happened. You know, you tar and feather, if you know anything about that, that is painful by itself. Okay, it burns your skin, and then they throw feathers on you just as like a way of mocking you. They stick to you, you can't get it off. You know, that sort of thing. Then they tie you to horses, set you on fire, and then whip the horses so the horses run in opposite directions, and that tears your body apart. This happens in full view of a woman who is pregnant and has a baby already. Okay. So the idea here is that she will see that happen, realize that death is on the menu. Then she will see you grab a whip and beat the other black male slave, put it kindly, to the point of death, but you don't kill him. And then she will be left frozen in fear. She will realize that she is helpless. Her protector has now been destroyed in front of her. And the reason that it's important that she witnesses it is so that she will then raise her children in reversed roles. Because if nothing happens to her, she feels like, okay, let me make sure that these people do not trip. I have a little boy. I do not want to see my boy get ripped apart in front of me. That is that type of trauma. You know,
and moreover, if I have a little girl.
Yeah, exactly. And if I have a little girl, I need to make sure that the little girl knows that she needs to be the person to interact with these slave masters.
In whichever way would make them less violent.
Mm. Now, the trauma of this type of thing. You know, you've seen slaves get whipped. You've seen slaves get killed, hung from trees, all this sort of stuff. You may not know that oftentimes when there was like a public, public may not be the right word, but widely shared punishment of a slave, that the rest of the slaves had to witness it. It kept everybody on the same page. This will happen to you if you break the eggs that you were supposed to be making for breakfast, or if you weren't quick enough in washing the master's clothes or whatever, you know, that sort of stuff. So you get whipped in front of everyone else. They see the blood, the flesh chunks, you know, getting whipped off of your back. And everyone else would bear witness to that trauma. It would then traumatize them and keep them frozen in fear, right? So this is kind of the result of that, you know, but it starts with showing the black woman what can happen to the black men. And then you raise your children in reverse roles. You raise the woman to be the strong one, the one to negotiate, the one to appeal, the one, you know, whatever, all these things. You raise the man, your male child rather, to be submissive, to be, you know, you don't want to have any problems with these people. Let's, you know, keep you in the shadows and, you know, just make sure you get to work and you work. And then when your work is done, then, you know, whatever, we can have our party on Sunday during church or whatever.
And when he says reverse roles, I don't want people to get the impression that you're raising the daughters to be strong, because you're raising them to be submissive as well. You're just raising them to be the ones that interact most.
Right.
That's because they're less likely to receive the amount of rage and physical abuse that your son will.
So I'll read a little bit more from this to make that point that you just suggested there. We'll skip down. It says, test her in every way because she is the most important factor for good economics. If she shows any sign of resistance in submitting completely to your will, do not hesitate to use the bullwhip on her to extract the last bit of B word, resistance, out of her. Take care not to kill her, for in doing so, you spoil good economics. When in complete submission, she will train her offspring in the early years to submit to labor when they become of age. So this is about as much as we can cover from this letter. And it kind of shows you, gives you a glimpse into the mentality of a slaver, right? Of a slaveholder, of a slave master, which is not something you often get.
Can you read that last line again, please?
When in complete submission, she will train her offspring in the early years to submit to labor when they become of age.
What a system to put in place.
And I want to go back to what you said, which is that the system was designed to be perpetual. So the family dynamic has been altered using a cemented by trauma that is now passed on. And even if you don't feel the actual trauma or recall the witnessing it, you know, the effects of that trauma are still very present.
Oh yeah, after a generation, this version of it isn't even as necessary anymore.
Right.
The parents are doing that teaching for you.
For you. And that's their natural state at that point. So unless something comes along to reset it, that's just kind of what it is. But fortunately, we're working on that too. Thank you for listening. It was important that you know that. We got to move on. So now it's time for the Way Black History Fact, which is a little bit more of the same. Today's Way Black History Fact, sponsored by Hip Hop Weekly Magazine. All the latest in hip hop culture is available at hiphopweekly.com. Today's Way Black History Fact comes from the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. And today's passage was written by Stephen Mintz. The title is Historical Context, American Slavery in Comparative Perspective. All right, I'll start. Of the 10 to 16 million Africans who survived the voyage to the New World, over one third landed in Brazil. Between 60 and 70% ended up in Brazil or the sugar colonies of the Caribbean. Only 6% arrived in what is now the United States. Yet, by 1860, approximately two-thirds of all New World slaves lived in the American South. For a long time, it was widely assumed that Southern slavery was harsher and crueler than slavery in Latin America, where the Catholic Church insisted that slaves had a right to marry, to seek relief from a cruel master, and to purchase their freedom. Spanish and Portuguese colonists were thought to be less tainted by racial prejudice than North Americans, and Latin American slavery was believed to be less subject to the pressures of a competitive capitalist economy. Remember in the section before, you know, you don't want to ruin sound economics, like we're not human beings. You know, we talked about the slave trade. You know, once you introduce the economics, now rather than warring tribes warring for the sake of whatever their disagreements are with land, territory, resources, they're warring just because they need to get more slaves so that they can buy. It's like an arms race. Anyway, I'll continue. In practice, neither the church nor the courts offered much protection to Latin American slaves. Access to freedom was greater in Latin America, but in many cases, masters freed sick, elderly, crippled, or simply unneeded slaves in order to relieve themselves of financial responsibilities. Death rates among slaves in the Caribbean were one-third higher than in the South, and suicide appears to have been much more common. Unlike slaves in the South, West Indian slaves were expected to produce their own food in their free time and care for the elderly and the infirm. The largest difference between slavery in the South and in Latin America was demographic. The slave population in Brazil and the West Indies had a lower proportion of female slaves, a much lower birth rate, and higher proportion of recent arrivals from Africa. In striking contrast, Southern slaves had an equal sex ratio, a high birth rate, and a predominantly African-born population.
A predominantly American-born population.
Sorry, that's exactly what I meant. A predominantly American-born population. Thank you for catching that one. Slavery in the United States was especially distinctive in the ability to, in the ability of the slave population to increase its numbers by natural reproduction. In the Caribbean, Dutch, Guyana, and Brazil, the slave death rate was so high and the birth rate so low that slaves could not sustain their population without imports from Africa. The average number of children born to an early 19th century Southern slave woman was 9.2, twice as many as in the West Indies. You're starting to kind of see how it was different even from Latin America, right? The slavery in the U.S. was different. And so the folks who try to hide behind the fact that, well, slavery was practiced around the world are ignoring the fact that the legacy of the slavery that was practiced here is a different beast. Slavery sucks all around the world. It had no positive impact on anybody who wasn't white or, you know, whatever. But yeah. Anyway, I'll continue. In the West Indies, slaves constituted 80 to 90% of the population, while in the South, only about a third of the population was enslaved. Plantation size also differed widely. In the Caribbean, slaves were held on much larger units, with many plantations holding 150 slaves or more. In the American South, in contrast, only one slaveholder held as many as 1,000 slaves, and just 125 had over 250 slaves. Half of all slaves in the United States worked on units of 20 or fewer slaves. Three quarters had fewer than 50. These demographic differences had important social implications. In the American South, slaveholders lived on their plantations and slaves dealt with their owners regularly. Most planters placed plantation management, supply purchasing, and the supervision in the hands of black drivers and foremen, and at least two-thirds of all slaves worked under the supervision of black drivers. Absentee ownership was far more common in the West Indies, where planters relied heavily on paid managers and on a distinct class of free blacks and mulattoes to serve as intermediaries with the slave population. Another important difference between Latin America and the United States involved conceptions of race. In Spanish and Portuguese America, an intricate system of racial classification emerged. Compared with the British and French, the Spanish and Portuguese were much more tolerant of racial mixing, an attitude encouraged by a shortage of European women, and recognized a wide range of racial gradations, including black, mestizo, quadroon, and octoroon. Don't ever use those words. The American South, in contrast, adopted a two-category system of race in which any person with a black mother was automatically considered to be black. So, again, there's a lot more reading that you can do there. One more time, it's at the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. This passage was written by Stephen Mintz, and the title is Historical Context, American Slavery in Comparative Perspective.
And that last thing was so that more people could be considered black, so that more people could be slaves.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that, again, it's important that, you know, today's episode is kind of winding down and giving our last thoughts. It's important to know really what slavery was, how it was different here, and what the legacy of it is.
And these were Cliff Notes, another Reader's Digest version.
Yeah.
So much more reading and information to do with regards to the differences of slavery on this continent.
Right.
Than anywhere else in the world, than anywhere else in world history.
Yep. And I recognize that you, our listener, are probably a kind human being, a human being who probably wants to do the right thing, maybe is searching for what the right thing is. And me and Q are very different. You know, we came up in a faith tradition. This was true in our house, which oftentimes was the most educated, you know, most the leader in the black communities, oftentimes the minister, preacher, religious figure. And we got opportunities to learn this history. So we know this and we recognize that you don't. And, you know, we have a show, we have a couple of microphones and some satellite dishes around the country. So recognizing that you may never have these conversations, these are things that may never make their way into your world. These passages may have otherwise never shaped your worldview. We felt it was important to share it with you today. And we appreciate you listening. We hope that you take this and digest it. Obviously, this is available as a podcast, so you can download it and run it back again. Or, of course, you can look everything up yourself. But that's going to do it for us today on Civic Cypher. Once again, I am your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja. I am Q Ward. And you have listened to another heavy episode, another heavy show with your friends at Civic Cypher.
Yes, indeed. Today's show is produced by our producer, Maggie B. Nowen. And please hit the website, civiccypher.com. Submit any questions, any topics you want us to cover. And you can also make a donation there as well and help us grow. The show is still growing and your support goes a long way. Follow us on all of our social media. We are at Civic Cypher. Of course, you can follow me and Q. I am at Ramses Ja.
I am Q Ward on all social platforms.
Yes, indeed. And of course, you can download this and any previous episode to get you a little bit more game in your life. We all need it. We all can use it. And hopefully, we're providing just that for you. And until next week, y'all, peace. Hey, yo, we handle it. These brothers are fabulous. Dilated, showing you where rhyme travel is. Worlds are spit tuned from sunlight to moon. Bussing off stage like gunfight saloons. Pull my mic back, you like that? Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Hardcore reporters with orders from headquarters. Behind enemy lines, sidestepping the borders. With press passes, we bring it to you as it happens. The streets love my crew for music and rapping. Street commander slash beat expander. Here to fight the slander with the proper propaganda. What's happening? You got a question, then ask it. The news is just a TV show. Get past it. And this from a quiet wartime journalist. Headlines. Wake up, refuse, and resist. Resist. Like this. Like this. Like this.
KBOO Portland. KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make